So, hello? Can you hear me? Yeah, I think so. So this is different. This is the kernel questioning. The kernel questioning is the type of session where the audience actually does all the work, and the speakers just have to give answers to the questions. But before we ask questions, I start with a question. Who of you here in the audience has ever, say, submitted some code to the Linux kernel? Raise your hand. So let me just count. Hello. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Wow. Okay, come up here to the stage, please, because you're going to be the ones who will answer the questions of the audience today. I prepared some chairs already, and could you please come and join me here on the stage? Give a hand to the wacky kernel hackers. I give you some more chairs. Jan, Alistair, it's easier to take a chair from the right-hand side. There have been more people before, so who raised his hand and didn't come here? So where? Ah, those, come on. Take a chair and... Heinz. Ah, okay. Well, Andrew, you have the best overview. Have you spotted anyone else? Okay, potential contributors. Okay, anyone else interested in answering question about the Linux kernel? All right. So, how does this work? Where's the microphone? Okay, excellent. Keep that. The kernel questioning is about asking questions about the kernel. Hence the name. And if you have any questions, I pass you the microphone, and the guys here on the stage will answer them, or at least try to. Before we start with that, I'd like to give a very short introduction, round of introduction of all the kernel hackers there. Maybe you could start, Alistair. Just tell your name and,
yep,
and
I'm
your project you are.
I'm Alistair Kurgan, AGK at Red Hat, working on Device Mapper in the kernel.
Hi, I'm Heinz Maulsagen, working with Red Hat, did the initial logical volume manager implementation and still working on Device Mapper and other stuff.
Hi, I'm Jan Blunk. I'm from SUSE, and I'm the kernel bug fixer there for enterprise stuff.
I'm Walter Harms. I don't work for any professional company, and I do some work for the Janitor project.
Hi, I'm Christoph Helvig. I'm working on lots of stuff, and I'm freelancer right now doing projects for IBM, for example.
Hi, I'm Jörn Engel, and I'm probably mostly known in the embedded area, MTD and stuff.
I'm Andrew Morton. I maintain the 3COM Ethernet driver.
Okay.
I'm Thomas Gleixner. I'm working on high-resolution timers, real-time preemption, and memory technology devices.
Hi, my name is Marcel Holtmann, and I'm basically working on Bluetooth and some other weird things.
I'm Steve Rusted. I help out with Ingo Molnar's RT patch, and I'm Thomas Gleichster's janitor.
Hi, I'm Carsten Otte. I work on the 390 project, 390 port for IBM.
Hi, I'm Holger Smolinski. I work on the Linux for the mainframe project with IBM as well.
Hello, my name is Matt Reckenburg. I'm a freelancer working for clusters on the different open source related projects like iSCSI or OpenMOSEX.
All right. Just keep the microphone. I have already a microphone on. Okay. So are there any questions to all these impressive kernel hackers, maintainers, code manglers, and so on? Any questions from the audience? So not so far. Okay, then. Okay, there is one. Anthony?
How many of you intended to be kernel maintainers or contributors, and how many just came into it by accident because of something you had to do anyway?
So who's going to answer that one?
Yeah, how many intended to be part of the Linux kernel and knew that's what you were going to be involved with the work that you were doing?
Yeah, and could you tell us a little bit about your motives of why did you, what was the main objective of becoming a kernel maintainer or kernel developer?
Well, I finished studying computer science, and I was interested in Linux as a user, and had the opportunity to come to IBM and join a new project. They hired people. I didn't have a clue about kernel development, but there were a couple of people around to learn from, Martin Twiedewski to name one, and yeah, there I learned kernel development.
Who else?
I always enjoyed sort of playing with embedded systems, low-level system software and things. I always sort of felt that what the Linux team were doing was something that I'd like to be involved in. And occasionally I was vaguely surprised to realize that I didn't have any, actually have any code in the kernel. And then one day I sort of decided to rectify that by just working on the kernel and fixing bugs. I think the kernel development team, some of the people are people who worked on Linux because they wanted to work on Linux, but increasing number of contributors now are people who work on Linux because that's what their boss told them to do. And a lot of people, I think, end up enjoying it, end up from the cultural and from the technical point of view, and they end up becoming kernel developers. I think some of them end up being people who want to continue doing it even if their boss told them to do something else.
All right. Someone else who answered that?
In my case, it was actually, you know, that I was running systems management in a large company and basically having all these Unixes, etc., with volume management, and I felt forced to do something about the lag of that in Linux. So that's what typically draws you into developing some application or, you know, some kernel enhancement, that there is something missing to you. And of course, you can't build just, you know, your single-person solution and expect it to be part of the Linux kernel someday. There must be, you know, at least two or three people who see you use for this, you know, new subsystem. And that's what brings it to into the Linux kernel, and that's what typically pulls you in.
So can one, in fact, distinguish between, well, kernel developers who get paid or who develop because their boss asked them to do something on the kernel, and the, well, enthusiastic freelancers and people who just code for fun. is this, can you distinguish these developers in terms of the quality of code or the type of code or the type of field they are working in?
I think the people who do it because they enjoy it end up doing a better job.
People who do it because they want to do it, I think they produce very high quality code at their own rate, and they're under no obligation to do so. People who are told to do it because that's their job, they get there eventually. But initially they come from a corporate development background, they've got a few things to learn. But generally in these companies there is somebody they can reach to who will explain things to them. And there's still a lot of people who contribute to the kernel for free because they enjoy doing so, but the good ones, I think they end up getting hired by somebody anyway. And it's often hard to tell when that's happened because they don't change their email address. So I really don't know who is working on the kernel professionally and who's doing it out of love. It's often hard to tell.
All right. Christoph?
Well, just because you're doing professional work on the kernel doesn't really mean you're not doing anything in your spare time. So pretty much everything interesting I did was in my spare time while I actually worked on kernel development for 4 years or something like that. So I spent a lot of time working, but that wasn't really the fun stuff. That's still better than a boring job, but the fun stuff is always spare time because the fun stuff is nothing someone wants to pay for.
So what is the fun stuff and what is the not so funny stuff?
Well, the not so fun stuff is usually maintaining some big thing like a file system or a port to a specific piece of hardware someone cares about. That can be quite boring work. It's just always customer coming with stupid bugs, stuff that just doesn't work somewhere, and you'll just have to sit down there and then just try to reproduce it and debug it, and it's just nasty sometimes, and then they have stupid features. And fun stuff is really going into things you care personally. I mean, that involves a lot of bug fixing too, but it's always stuff you actually care about. I mean, I couldn't care less if someone does something stupid and I have to fix it, but that's my job. And if something's broken I want to use, that's a lot more interesting. Or what's even more interesting is to write some cool new feature.
All right. There was some comment over here. Marcel?
Talking something else, but... Actually, I kind of like fixing bugs. I find that almost being like a cat and mouse type of chase thing, especially race conditions. I actually kind of... as I found several in the kernel before too, but I could get my kernel to cause the race, but I can't get the vanilla kernel to cause the race. But it exists.
All right. Another comment?
Yeah, I just want to fully agree with Andrew about the quality and motivation of the developer itself. Like someone who is curious about a new feature in the kernel or curious to port things to a new architecture by doing it himself or herself, is to my mind also much more motivated to do it in a good way, in the right way, than by just doing the job and waiting for the salary at the end of the month.
Yeah, I remember when I first trying to figure out what the program, I chose lots of different open source projects. I tried a while back ago, I guess in 1996, I tried to get more involved with GTK and whatnot, and I found out that when I submitted my first patch to GTK, I think I spent 8 hours on code that was like 20 lines. And that's because I was so nervous. I'm like, this is code that the world will see. This is not code that, you know, when I was in business or working at Lockheed Martin, I would just write code, slap it out, you know, and no one's going to see this. And if someone does, they don't know that I wrote it because it's owned by Lockheed Martin. Where one thing I love about the open source community is when you write code and you send out code, your name is attached. Good or bad, your name is attached. So when you feel more personal about it, I think people who open source code, I think it's basically better code because the people writing the code are worried about, okay, this is my reputation on the line. People will see my skills. So I think they take much more time than if you're like with a bunch of people in a company and who cares.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So more questions from the audience to this field of subject? So what I'd like to ask you is, we talked a little bit about coding for fun and maybe for money, and it's the funny stuff is getting new things into the kernel, and the not so funny stuff maybe bug fixing and other maintenance stuff.
I disagree.
You disagree? Okay.
This absolutely depends on the person. Some people are more interested in new features and their own private toy that they created. And there's also people that are really good at bug hunting, bug fixing, and care a lot more about that, or people that just want to do janitor stuff that to where some developer wrote a small entry. The whole kernel should be checked for this thing, and they go through and check the whole kernel for this thing, which is absolutely boring to, I guess, 90%, 99% of all kernel developers, but not to this one person. So it's really personal.
All right.
Okay, because I'm part of the janitor network, so I may answer this also.
Speak to the microphone.
Okay, the interesting part to be a janitor is you don't have to worry about too much. When you make a patch for SCSE subsystem, you may break the SCSE subsystem also. And if you are like me, a more or less hobby programmer, you simply want to learn about the kernel, and you can step through the whole kernel looking for some specific features and find, okay, this is Mr. Andrew Morton, who was a famous programmer, but I found he had not checked the return code there, and I do it. And this is the fun part for me. So I can see what do the other people? What do they wrong? What do they right? And it's, of course, it's also for me a feedback when this part is part of a patch and comes into the main kernel.
Okay. Christoph?
Yes, actually, this fixing small bugs and refactoring stuff, like having a pattern all over that's just duplicated in gazillions of places, it's actually something I spend a considerable, huge amount of time on. It's always, you have an idea for a cool feature, and you do an outline, like hack up a prototype, and then you notice, well, we could refactor this, and it actually makes sense, and you start with a huge bug fixing and cleanup series that just goes all over, and half a year later, you're back to your initial feature after you fix the gazillion bugs and refactor stuff to be a lot smaller that was already there. So, yeah, that's the pattern I see in my work.
All right. So the size of the kernel in terms of functionality, in terms of lines of code, has increased ever since. Can you project this growth into the future? Will this keep on growing on and on? Or is there some kind of a complexity deadlock at some point? Systems become more and more complex as the code size grows in itself. How can such an important project like the Linux kernel deal with these kinds of problems?
I don't think the code size growth necessarily means increased complexity. I mean, the size of the Linux kernel largely is new device support, new platform support, and basically we're tracking the growth in the hardware market there. Every time a manufacturer comes out with a new chipset, a new architecture type, new device drivers, new devices, well, stuff goes into the tree. That doesn't necessarily increase the complexity. It increases the maintenance burden. But there are changes we make in the core kernels, like things like priority inheriting futixes, remapped file pages, HR timers, and things like that. And the changes we made to memory reclaim to support reverse mapping are fiercely complex. These were driven by performance requirements, and it decreases the number of people who can maintain the core code, and it increases the amount of work a person needs to do to become competent at maintaining the core kernel, and that is a real concern. We're seeing new features coming along, such as the NUMA support and the file system asynchronous AIO support, which has been stuck for a couple of years. And one of the concerns there is we don't want to add too much complexity of the core kernel and make it less maintainable. So it's those changes in that core kernel, which is just a tiny fraction of the kernel, it is getting more complex, and the learning curve is getting steeper.
How can you resolve this general problem, or what is an approach to resolve this problem?
I think we need to be stricter about the things we accept. I think we've made some mistakes in the past, particularly like the remap file pages function, which is in the kernel. I think we should never have done it. It's added considerable complexity to the core MM, and we don't support it fully, and I wish we hadn't done that. So we just need to be more careful about what we accept, I think.
Okay. Does this mean that the speed of development should be a little bit more slowed down?
I think it should be slowed down, if only to manage the defect rate, which I pointed out earlier today.
Okay. So I'd like to ask all of you. There's a comment of Christoph.
So one important part about the growing size is actually that we need to have, we actually have stricter standards on all that stuff we have. If you look back to Linux kernel 7 years ago, no one really cared what your drivers look as long as it supported something new and cool and worked. And these days we actually have pretty high standards that people format the code all the same everywhere, and they use the right subroutines instead of implementing stuff over and over. And this is actually an important part. If you grow and you have to do people doing maintenance over the whole tree, they just have to be, just to get in where somewhere and feel familiar. So someone, we have a lot more strict conventions, and we try to factor out as much as possible code into common helpers. So it is easier for people to actually maintain it. It doesn't matter if every driver looks different. If you have four of them, if you have 130 drivers, it's more important they actually look similar so you can fix them all over for something.
And I believe the kernel has already gone a long way in that direction. If you take a look at some old and dusty areas in the kernel, like driver CD-ROM or JFFS, that have basically been untouched for the last 5 years, and you read that code and compare it to any code that has been touched in the last year, it is a huge difference. And you know for sure which code you want to read and you want to change and which you don't care about.
Okay.
I see it more as a general problem, not only for the Linux kernel, which is a really huge, or which is the really huge project in the Linux world, but also for every other bigger project, that the general service offered by the project becoming so complex that it gets stuck in development, because adding stuff or removing stuff will cause a lot of hassle. Because you need to understand the whole system, and this can, to my mind, only being solved by separating the core part from the different subsystem, and having clear interfaces between them, like APIs where developers of a subsystem can just add functionality and enhancement to the main core system without touching the core base code at all. So sure, there must be developers which are maintaining and enhancing the core system, but to separate this in several subsystems and have a good interface is also a good solution to keep the core as small as possible.
Okay. Yeah.
I have a very simple question, but a serious question. How do you test? Do you do it just by magic and it's a wonderful perfect code, or do you do serious testing? Do you use regression tests, or what do you do for a perfect code?
Well, as for 390, we don't have too much users. We're a small architecture with regard to the amount of users, and on the other hand, we have very sophisticated users. When you have a big, huge bank using your software, you don't want it to fail. So we do have a test team that full-time tests our code. But
do you do it yourself? Or
no, we have a test team of people who just do it full-time. After we have done some basic functional test, and we hope that ensures stability.
I just want to add, everyone here is a potential tester. Please go to kernel.org. You'll see that there's a RC branches, or you'll see 17-RC3. There's a MM branch that right now it's at RC3, MM1. Please download those, and please try running those kernels. And if there's a problem, please report it to the kernel mailing list. That's actually what we're looking for. And I know Andrew would like to have people, more people using the MM branch.
Maybe the answer to this question is somehow related to the previous question, which is the pure size and amount of supported hardware or other things with the kernel. There is a very huge regression risk today. If you change something, it's very likely that you break one architecture or a set of device drivers, which is widely used. And the only thing to prevent this is to increase test coverage as far as possible, and that means almost everybody has to test. So please, all of you, if there is a change and you get the hardware, try it.
I would like to make my question a little bit more precise. I would like to know what you by yourself do to test the code. Because you can, of course, if you have to develop a lot of things, you can split the work. You have one test team, you have the developer, but of course a developer could just develop code, do not test it, just leave it up to a test group. But do you do tests by yourself? That was my basic question. And do you have some systematic approach to do this? Use tools or whatever?
The answer is yes, and in many, many various ways. A fairly simple and maybe sometimes too common way is to just ship the code and have you test it. The usual... I won't say anymore. Compile time tests are done by most developers on most patches, not always. What I personally do for some of my projects is QMU or VMware or some other virtualization system where you can take the kernel you just hacked on, run it, take some root file system and run your usual regression test suite on it. That is really good, especially since if I do something stupid and the system crashes, my laptop still works. So QMU is really great and it's not the only choice for it. And one often underestimated method of testing is reading. Reading the source, reading your own source before you submit it, reading someone else's code after it hits the mailing list, and saying, hey, this cannot work, ever. You just did something stupid. That is testing, and that helps a lot.
So what's actually pretty useful is if you have some kind of automated QA test case. For example, on XFS, where I worked for a few years, we had a real nice huge set of test cases. It actually took long because it did all this nasty stuff to a file system, like overfilling it and having really bad memory pressure. That kind of stuff works nice for a file system, but it's pretty hard to do if you're touching 3 gazillion drivers and you actually have hardware for only 2 of them. And for those, you just can make sure it compiles, it works with the hardware you have, and for everything else you have to rely on others. So the kind of testing you can do depends a lot on what area you actually do changes to.
Jan?
So in the enterprise bug fixing region, it's often that the customer comes with a test case or just crashing application, and then you try to minimize the problem to a test case. And then you go and read where the bug is, and then you fix it, and then you try the test case again. So there is a file system environment, there's a deep bench and a lot of other
test cases which you can download and just let them run, but usually applications of the customer do something totally different. And so every test case works, but not the specific application of a few customers. So
there are a couple of groups who've invested considerable resources in setting up automated test harnesses. For example, OSDL have done that, IBM have done that as well. So they have farms of servers which will download the latest kernel and put a whole bunch of stress tests on them. Big machines, 8 CPU machines, lots of disks and that sort of thing. Now, one can test the effectiveness of a test setup by asking yourself, how many bugs has this test setup found? And I would say that those systems which have had a considerable amount of work invested in them have probably found about 0.05% of our bugs. They're just not finding the bugs. All the useful bug reports we have come in from people in the field who've downloaded the kernel and tested it. And this tells us that setting up these automated test harnesses, it's a good thing to do, thank you for doing that, but it's just not finding the bugs as effectively as those people who are doing testing for us.
And are you satisfied with the current situation of people downloading the kernel code, running it and reporting bugs, or is it necessary to report more?
No, I'm extremely happy with them, but I'm not happy with the rate at which we respond to them.
Okay.
We're getting more bugs than we're fixing, more reports than we're fixing.
Mm-hmm. So, testing, yes, in forms of syntactical tests, for example, if you have, or semantical tests, if you have, you were talking about the priority inheritance futixes, you can validate the functionality, but you can only validate it with a given set of tests. But you don't have a chance in an automated test or regression test to find out any possible use case users come up with, and those use cases mostly find the bugs or bring the bug to the surface. So definitely we do a lot of testing, and I think most of the developers actually test their patches as long as they have hardware for that. If you're working in a core kernel code, it's simple because it affects every machine. But if you have device drivers, network drivers, you don't have any every type of card in your test environment, so it doesn't work.
There's one thing: if it's not only kernel related, it's in development in general. If the GCC or any other compiler has a warning, don't ignore it. See why it's there. It's really important. Yeah. Even the kernel itself has still some warnings. Some are simply false positives by the GCC, but simply need to understand why they are there. In most cases, they are real. There really is a problem. Another thing that I find quite useful lately is a fuzzing. So you simply run weird situations totally randomly and let it run for a day or something and see how the kernel reacts if it crashes, because you have maybe covered all possible use cases, but you can change two operations and then the kernel oopses or it happens something, which a normal programmer would never do. But running a random program that executes random system calls might find these. But then if you find these, you have to track them down, and tracking down is not really easy. Getting from fuzzy and finding the bug to fixing the bug is kind of hard.
The thing with compiler warnings or just any code checkers warnings is something I forgot. It's a two-sided sword. With code checkers, you can find a lot of stuff, and it is a very powerful weapon in the right hands, and it's a very dangerous weapon in the wrong hands, because some developers tend to make the warning go away. They call it fixing the warning, but all it does is leave the bug where it is, and the warning is gone, so no one knows about it, no one notices. And then 2 years later, someone comes up and says, oops, my kernel is oopsing. Where could that be? And you could have found it fairly early in the development process if the warning had actually stayed there and someone that knows how to fix the actual bug had looked at it, and people don't just say, I'll cast this to void and that's fine.
One thing I don't think we do very well is deliberate fault injection. For example, you have a device driver. How many device drivers do we have which you can easily go in and simulate a bad sector or a bad checksum on a packet reception? I don't think we do that very much. So what happens is somebody out there actually has dead hardware, and they come and say, oh, look, my kernel hung up or oopsed, because we have no way of testing that. If we had some sort of common infrastructure to do that, perhaps it might encourage people to use it.
Okay, there was a question over here.
Well, hardware vendors are very often very reluctant when it comes to releasing technical documents for writing, for example, device drivers. I once wanted to write a driver for a digital camera by a big manufacturer and couldn't get any technical specs. What would you recommend, or what are you doing when you have some hardware which you would like to support, or don't you buy it at all?
So who's working on device drivers?
I think that there's no really good solution for it, but you can at least try to contact them. Sometimes it's you can convince them once you get the sales department behind you and find some decent guy who's really knowing what they're talking about. What I figured out is if you start reverse engineering and really scare them, so, oh, by the way, I don't need you anymore. I understood what you are really doing, and I found your bugs in your hardware, which you don't even know of. Then they come to you and they be friendly, but sometimes you have no choice. We will have hardware that will never be supported, never ever.
Give an example.
I don't want to name any names. No way. But I think the obvious candidates are, if you go into the Wi-Fi part of wireless card, then you get the obvious candidates of not being playing nice, and or graphics card to protect some crazy IP to whatever reason.
And why do you say never ever? I made the experience that, well, a lot of people said, well, this type of hardware will never ever be supported by the Linux kernel, and well, I as a pure user and not a developer said, well, let's just wait for, well, a couple of months or just 1 or 2 years, and well, at least in, say, 80% of those cases, I met the experience, there was somebody who invented some way or the other to support that kind of hardware. Isn't that a sign that we just need enough pressure and enough requests for a certain type of hardware and it will be supported? Or what are the attributes of a hardware or a situation when some hardware is never ever supported?
Some promises, some parts is easy to do reverse engineering, but not everybody has fun with reverse engineering, and some people don't have really the power to get it to the end and have a driver ready. They start understanding a little bit of it, and then, okay, yeah, I have something, I post it, and nobody picks it up. I've seen that before with some drivers. Okay, I got this far, and so you pick it up. Some ISDN cards, for example, I don't have the time to code the rest, and it simply just stays there. You posted some, and it stays there, except you don't go to the complete way. Okay, I reversed in everything. I wrote the driver. I tested it with a lot of hardware. Now we have a driver. And sometimes this happens. Best example is maybe the Broadcom wireless driver, the BCM or BC44XX, which is actually quite good right now, and some Apple fans or big onion people will really like it, and they're absolutely happy about it. But for some hardware, the life cycle of the hardware is too short that enough people are buying it. So if you have a life cycle of a hardware that is 1 year, then you buy already new hardware, except you're some kind of fanatic guy keeping old hardware and trying to support it. I, for example, have a Bluetooth PCMCA card, which I really try to support, and there's no way because this company got sold to Motorola, and Motorola lost the specification. So, no chance at all. And even the original guy who worked at the company says, yeah, well, I did something, but I don't remember, and this card is 6 years old, and I like to support it. If they give me the specification, I'm happily writing the driver for the oldest piece of hardware that I can find, but they don't have it anymore, and some part the reverse engineering stops and you can't do it anymore. Or I can't do it anymore. There may be some people out there that can, so I'm happy to work with them to get this working, but it's troubling. And we are good in getting drivers working, reverse engineering drivers in the last years. It's getting better and better. And on the other side, companies come to us and get the specification out and help us to working on it. For example, get the Wi-Fi part again, the Intel Wi-Fi card. It took quite some time. I think it's a year or 1.5 years before the IPW drivers finally got around. But they are now great. And so it gets there. And sometimes waiting is worthwhile. Sometimes you wait forever.
Intel nowadays are very good with device support. The story with the forced ETH driver was fun. That's for the Ethernet Mac, which is in the NVIDIA chipset. They wouldn't give us any specs. So a bunch of guys, mainly Manfred Sproul, got down and reversed engineered it and came up with a driver that's sufficiently good. And now we're getting patches against that from NVIDIA, which is... they obviously looked at it and decided to support us in that. But to some extent, I'm hoping some of this problem will go away. For example, 3D controllers, and the day will come when Intel is going to go put a 3D controller on the chipset, and that's going to be good enough for most people. And ETH, wireless Macs and things like that, they're going to end up integrated, and I think there's going to be quite a shakeout in the market. Companies like Intel and AMD will support Linux on it, and so the magnitude of these problems hopefully will become less as the market shakes out.
Questions from the audience? So we have talked a little, somewhere over here? Ah, okay. Sorry.
This is an unrelated, very technical question. I know how to debug a C program, for example, with GDB or so, but how do you debug an operating system kernel when it's running?
I use GDB.
I quite often use just print case, rerun the test case again. If it's reproducible, that works fairly well. And sometimes you have those hard problems where you keep on scratching your head for days or weeks and finally can trace it down to some SKB not getting freed early enough so you don't get any resends on TCP within half an hour, which is really odd behavior, and it takes you from the Ethernet driver to this TCP problem weeks or months to get it down. And it's some things are just beyond. But I guess there's nothing special about the kernel. If you get a sufficiently complicated user space program and you have race conditions in there, you have weird communication, maybe not with hardware but with other programs, it gets complicated as well.
What I use is my own little ring buffer device. It's called LogDev. I've submitted it a couple times to the Linux Chrome and listened and got laughed at. But the anyway, it's something actually I will clean it up better and I will submit it again and make it run on top of RelayFS or whatever it's called today. And well, what's nice about it is what you do is you could, it writes to the memory, and it could be done in interrupt context or any other type of context. I write this all over the place inside the kernel where the problem is. Sometimes I call it the shotgun approach, where you just kind of like put it in almost every single function. And when on a oops or a panic or NMI lockup, it spritz out. Like I usually have like maybe 3 megs or 4 megs of log data that gets printed out over the serial port. And a lot of times, especially on SMP, it shows really nicely how the interaction happened where a race conditioning was caused, which I, without this log buffer, in fact, actually I'm pretty amazed that these guys can actually debug their code without something like this. I don't know if they probably have their own version of it, but it's something that I usually use quite a bit to find race conditions.
I bet everybody of the core kernel developers has his own version of LogDev and his own private hack to do that.
That's, well, yeah. That's right. On 390, we do have the possibility to run the whole kernel in a virtual machine, and there you have full debugging capabilities like you would expect from GDB or a similar debugger like breakpoints and stuff, but not on a source code level, but on a instruction level, you can trace on instructions. So that's what we use. Plus,
usually we need to be able to debug something that occurred at a customer once, which is not reproducible. And in that case, we have the possibility to get to retrieve a memory dump on the entire memory content from the user machine. And the user sent us this memory dump. And with this, we're able to, first of all, get the panic message or oops message, which is usually very helpful. So in case you submit a bug, please, when your dying kernel does print some output, please attach it to your bug report. Plus, we are able to look into data structures of the kernel, and usually it helps, not always, most of the time.
One relatively new capability we have in the kernel is the ability to crash dump, so that when the kernel crashes or initiated by external manual action, we can dump an image of the kernel, all the memory in the machine, onto disk. I've been pushing pretty hard to try and get this feature ready for prime time. It's still not quite there yet. But I'm hoping that some point in time the distros will start to support it. And our way of analyzing failures on, for example, x86 platforms will be to ask the user to initiate a crash dump, and then he'll send the entire image of his kernel, compress it, stick it on the server somewhere, so then a kernel developer can download it and start poking around through the user's memory. I think that will help us to resolve quite a lot of problems at present, which via the remote control method by which we do debug kernels.
I've used this for my company for quite a while, and our patch is not as clean as kdump. It's quite tasteless, so it will never make it into the mainline kernel. It won't even try. But the results are quite good. For a developer to take a look at the crash dump and dig through the whole kernel image to find the bug and find the cause of the bug is quite painful. So whoever starts doing this for the first couple of times will be cursing like sailors. But you do find problems that are really hard to trace down and basically not non-reproducible. It is a really great tool.
You can analyze these crash dumps with either crash or lcrash from the Linux kernel crash dump utilities. And you also can write macros. So in lcrash, you can write for problems or for structures that you want to look at quite often. You can write a macro and then just load it and debug in it. And crash is actually an old version of GDB. And it's working quite good. So when the dump is valid, because sometimes on architectures different than S390, you have the problem that sometimes the dump is corrupt, so missing pages or something. So then you're lost.
Well, OpenSolaris has some very nice infrastructure for debugging kernel and post-mortem analysis and that sort of things, which is called dtrace. Have you considered something similar for the Linux kernel? Few.
I'm probably the wrong person to talk about. Everybody was. Does anybody know?
Well, yeah, it's basically dtrace done even worse. It's like a consortium from IBM, Red Hat, and all these folks that just work on Linux because they're paid for it and the code looks like that. So there's a basic underlying functionality, and that's kprobes. That's something we have in the kernel that basically allows you to set a trap at a random address, usually at a function entry or exit. That's a pretty simple C API, which is very useful. You just write your own kernel module, and then you can trap functions at runtime without having to change anything in the kernel image. So these guys took that basic functionality and then built the dtrace lookalike around that. And dtrace is, for those that don't know, it's basically a scripting language that looks somewhat like C, but quite different, maybe like C or awk or something in the middle, that allows you to write that with scripts. And they have all kinds of brain damage in there trying to limit a user shooting themselves in the feet, like limiting recursion and whatever. Then they can write scripts to access all the variables, and system tap does this kind of thing on top of K probes. And I talk to these people a lot, and they're very into doing the same thing Thun does because they need it for the marketing, and that's what drives all this, unfortunately. I've written up a design on how to do that better for them, but I don't really have time to do that myself, and they're not interested in listening. And that would involve providing a nice set of C APIs that we can use for K-probes, because C is the language every kernel developer needs to know and needs to write in any way. And having a nice way to look at stack variables or whatever by the runtime, we have debug information at debug kernel, would be extremely useful, but I really couldn't get them to do that for a C API because they just want to copy one-to-one what Sun does for the marketing stuff.
All right, so we talked a lot about existing infrastructure and problems and processes, and what about the future? So
the future will be great and shiny.
Yeah, well, for how long, when did the 2.6 kernel actually, when was it published the first time? 2.5 years ago, even longer?
3 years ago, December. Yeah, think that Christmas, so yeah, it made 2.5 years ago.
Okay, so will we ever see something like a 2.7, 2.8 construct in the near or the medium future, or 3.0 or whatever?
You will see all the features you would want it to have in it.
Pardon?
You will see all the features you would expect in 2.8.
But why is the current situation that, well, is it stuck, or is it just is the kernel more or less approaching a level of of perfectness or something? Is it going to be perfect? So no new features are needed that make room for a new version number change?
Well, the usual argument is that we have lots of small changes, which aren't really that small, but not really big and groundbreaking. If you look at the 2.3 series, we had like a huge rework of the networking code. We had an introduction of the unified page cache and so on and so on. So all the series did like a huge rework of major, very core subsystems. And right now we don't have anything like that pending. That's why people try to stabilize a feature at a time and get that in. I don't know if we're actually going to rewrite the kernel in C++ after we've all been drunken and signed our lives to the devil. Maybe we'll start at 3.0.
I like C++. I'm sorry.
You mentioned the kernel stuck. Actually, it's not stuck. Everybody that has nothing to do for a week or so and a new kernel release is appearing, sign up for the day when the next kernel is released by Linus and see the LKML mailing list and see how many people sending patches in. And don't miss a day. It's funny. I think you end up with whatever was the last time, 300, 400 emails in 2 hours or 3 hours, something was unbelievable. And Fedora managed to actually release the Fedora Core 5 at the same day, so it was funny two times. There's a lot of work going on, and I think we don't need another version number. It's only a number. Who cares?
Okay, but does this mean that we won't have any major new features in the future? So and we just keep on, well, doing some bug fixing and performance patching and stuff like that?
There are always new features. Even the 2.4 kernel had new features and supposed to be stable at that time.
No, I think we get new features, but they get in gradually. So we don't use the 2.5 or 2.7 model to throw all the new features in one go and then have a long period of bug fixing. No, we move the kernel gradually to the new features and to new sets of functionality.
Yeah, like Andrew mentioned in his speech, he said that now it seems to be people, when a feature comes in, it's broken up a lot more in little pieces and it slowly evolves. And someone gets a little bit in, then they work more on it, and then they add more, and it slowly evolves. Where I think probably in the past, I don't really remember, but was there a lot more just major change? I'll ask that, or...
more major changes were needed in those days because the kernel wasn't as good. But we've made major changes in the 2.6 series. I mean, we've done some pretty fundamental things in the memory management area and the block layer, etc. But we have the processes in place that these things don't go into Linus's tree until they're in pretty good shape. So we still got the capacity to do those things, although our need to do them has reduced. But the kernel's supposed to be boring places. It's supposed to be just a maintenance exercise.
Okay. Christoph? Or? Okay. Questions for this subject? The kernel team or the kernel developer community agrees to do this kind of change of development models. Is this intermediate situation, and will there be in some future again some development and sustainable kernel branches, or is this the current situation? And well, obviously there can be some change in the future any time, but is this planned? Is this a planned intermediate situation?
So after this session, I'll get out my crystal ball and then I'll tell you this and all the other nice bits about the shiny future I'll read out of it. It's just, we can't really tell you what's going on in 5 years because we just don't know. There's no immediate plan to change that, but never say never.
Right now, I think it's very hard for me to envisage any catastrophe which would be sufficiently large to force us to create a new kernel version. I just don't see anything coming down the track which would be so large, so disruptive, that we'd figure we'd have to have a separate tree for a multi-year development effort.
Okay.
Well, if you compare the current situation with what we used to have before, like from the developer's or user's perspective, now as a developer you have a quite short time from when your work is finished and tested and everything is good until you have it at the user in the next development cycle. And before, like in the 2.5 series, you couldn't get your feature into 2.4 because 2.4 was more or less closed, and unless you have something really very critical. And yes, you can put it into 2.5, but nobody cares about 2.5 because nobody uses 2.5. So the current situation is much more convenient.
Okay.
Yeah, and one more challenge with the previous model was that if you developed something on the odd version of the kernel, it was very likely that this version at some point in time destabilized and you had to do everything on your own, or you were stalled with your development activities because you had no basis to do something. It was just kind of instable. And today you have a stable platform, and as soon as you get your things stabilized, you can roll it out to your customers or to your users, as Carsten mentioned, and that's a very convenient position.
Okay, more questions on this? So, audience, okay.
Maybe a question in the other direction. Does anyone in the audience have a clear opinion on where we utterly suck, where we are doing a great job, how we should change?
So what feature are you from the audience lack most from the kernel guys? Is there some things you are really annoyed of?
2.8 will be a microkernel.
All right. If you guys, I think we have to make a last round of questions and answers. And if you guys had to write something on a big wish list, independent of how easy that could be done today, what's your number one or number one and number two items on your personal wish list for the Linux kernel for the next, say, 5 years? Would you like to start here?
From my point of view, I can just say I'm pretty much satisfied already with the development of 2.6 and the enhancement that were made there. I'm very much looking forward to have a robust and good working cluster file system like OCFS and in the Linux kernel, next to, of course, OSCSI.
Well, from the mainframe point of view, it would be very interesting to further increase, let's say, debugging capabilities, availability capabilities, also kernel itself, serviceability as well, and that would bring us a very strong value, like, for instance, doing some more tracing or some more unified messaging, which would help us very much. Today, when things change every day, when messages are the same in 20 places of the code and they have to analyze a dump to determine which instance of the message you really get and all these things, that's annoying when you're going to work with it.
I want to run 10 instances of different operating systems on my laptop.
Considering my background, I would like the vanilla Linux kernel be the best embedded real-time OS out there.
Actually, I have some. It's not 5 years; it's near future. Basically, what's always a problem is power management, and power management for the embedded series, so you can running Linux on your mobile phone on whatever, and get these things really sorted out and make them more public, and have these guys following the mainline kernel and not doing their stuff on their own, stuck with 2.4 or something, and goes in the same. I don't develop in this, but we need the real time part at some point, and maybe put Linux in some spaceships. There's some weird series what NASA and European Space Agency are trying to do with some funny stories what they have plans for. And basically you will see Linux having everywhere, and I've just saw an email from Harald Walter what he managed with the Motorola mobile phone just when he spent his nice days in Brazil for the last 2 weeks, and I think we will see a lot of nice things there, but we have some challenges to overcome, and embedded and power management is one of the big ones that I see we have to sort out. And I like to have Sten working, even though Andrew don't really like to merge it, but I like to have it somehow working.
Well, real-time capabilities and high-resolution timers is my first top on the wish list, and I'm working hard to get this. On the other hand, embedded is certainly a thing I care of. I do a lot of embedded work, and that's needs care and needs also power, because the tester base on embedded is very, very small, because most people don't have an embedded board. But you have basically the same problem then on the x86 desktop PC. And that's a little bit scary on embedded development.
Actually, I bet pretty much every one of us actually has some embedded Linux device, they just don't know about it.
Right.
I guess the kernel development team's become more professional over time, and I think there are more advances we can make in that area to do with, bug tracking. If you look at projects like GNOME, KDE, and GCC, they have very strong processes about tracking and resolving their bugs. And I expect the kernel team will become more responsible and careful about that over time, and I think we need to. We'll never go as far as those projects will do so, and that'd just be inappropriate technically in the kernel context. But I expect we'll become better about that over time. And I think also we could become more aggressive about throwing things out of the kernel. There's a lot of crap in there that nobody really uses anymore. And probably time come to be a little bit more harsh about throwing some of those old things out.
I would like to actually get some of X into the kernel, the stuff that talks directly to the hardware. I really hate this piece of user space program to turn my computer... I would not comment on that. I really hate this piece of user space program that should be fairly safe to use to turn my laptop into a brick, or at least temporarily into a brick, so I have to reboot, and the kernel would be running fine if X didn't mess things up. So a clean interface between X and all hardware control in the kernel would be nice.
So one of the more short-term is in next year, which lift items is sort out the wireless networking mess. There's a driver for pretty much every piece of wireless hardware for Linux. Very few of that are in the kernel tree. Very few are up to our quality standards. They all have their own stacks. They don't use common code for software Mac. So that's a very important thing to get right. So you can use all the wireless hardware everywhere with a single interface, with all the capabilities it has, like access point support, so all the different encryption schemes. Also, I would recommend people use IPsec over it because they all suck. But anyway, get this coherent, get this right, like we do for all other devices. Our wireless support right now just sucks, and it shouldn't.
Oh, from the janitorial side, I can only say we are happy if a user can set any combination of any devices without getting a warning from somewhere. It's often the case when you set certain defines inside and a device driver doesn't compile anymore, or a device driver suddenly starts to send out warnings what didn't notice become before. And we really are hardworking this to change, but it's hard work because you have to find any combination of any possible define that is inside the kernel.
Yeah, I'm running out of ideas here so much. But my first wish is yet another debugging feature, maybe this time cross-platform and just working. So that would be...
But it should. My wish would be that in a couple of years from now we'd end up with a fully implemented resource management platform in and on Linux, which means that you would be able to define classes of objects, say applications, and decide that this class is not going to have more than such and such percentage of your disk throughput or whatever, like CPU utilization. There's work going on, but we are not yet there. Yeah, and on the other hand, of course, more games which run on Linux, right? Because we want to have more kids catching up with Linux and taking it into, you know, the businesses of this world.
Yeah, so you put some Easter eggs into the kernel. Yeah. I'd like to see on the clustering side, clustered mirrors, clustered snapshots, all sorts of fancy things we could do if we just had more developers working on it. We're just short of time.
So raise your hands if you want to do development in that area.
Okay. Yes, guys, thank you very much for attending, and even more, thank you so much for giving us this wonderful and important stuff of software we hopefully all use every day, and I really rely on it. Thanks for coming, and keep on the good work.